My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with M. Thomas Cooper. Can I call you Mike?
Absolutely.
Or do you need to be called M?
No, M's a little too mysterious. It makes us be James Bondy in 007.
It sounds like a Peter Lorre movie. You know? The title of your novel is 42, and it's published by Ooligan Press. Can we talk about Ooligan Press for a minute or two?
Because, absolutely. Yeah.
Ooligan Press is local. They're a bunch of students.
Yeah, master's Portland, students.
Portland State University and a publishing a curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find Ooligan Press?
Basically, I kind of had heard of them. I was a student at one time and sort of still am, kind of, you know, in and out. And at the time after I'd gotten done with the book itself, I had, you know, sent it out and stuff like that to some of the bigger publishers, and they weren't really interested. So I thought I'd start local, tried Hawthorne books and such. And then I heard of Ooligan, and I tried them, and somehow magically out of the slush fund, mm-hmm. they accepted it. And one thing led to another, and now it's out.
Is this your first book?
It's the first one that's got published. I have, of course, the sophomoric autobiographical one about the bike racing bartender, which thankfully, I suppose, was not published. So this is the first published one, yeah.
Where do you attend bar?
Right now, I don't. That was a while.
Because you've made so much money from your writing?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, I'm living off the royalties right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Flying down to Vegas tomorrow.
Good luck with that. Be sure to take a plane.
Yes.
42. The minute I got this book, I said, "Oh, it's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy."
Right.
42. The answer to the world, the universe, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of. I mean, it's a very very tiny.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Why 42? I mean, what? There was a movie recently called 28, I believe.
I think it was 23. With
23. Yeah. I gave
Jim
it five.
Carrey, Jim
yeah,
Carrey, yeah,
5 points more than it deserved.
Yeah.
About an obsession with a number. It's, mm-hmm. That's just a small part of this book, though, right?
Right, yeah. I guess when I was writing it, I realized that George, the main character, needed like a sort of a linchpin or something to latch onto to reunite with his family. And somehow 42 seemed appropriate, you know, based on Douglas Adams such. And it seems like it's also just kind of come into sort of a social vernacular, like we reference in the book, you know, where it kind of creeps up just in every day in the movies and such like that. And it's become part of sort of a subconscious cultural thing. And
yeah, I remember the year I turned 42, I expected everything to be revealed. Mm-hmm. And guess what?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Didn't, yeah.
Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. You want to talk to Douglas about that? It's like, wait a minute, Mr. Adams.
Before we get into, deeply into the characters, although George Olsen is the main character, mm-hmm. and his wife Francesca and his daughter Mirabella go missing, and that starts the plot in motion. But let's talk a little bit about a couple of things. This book treads into territory that's it's not unfamiliar territory. Alfred Hitchcock has done similar work to this.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly Franz Kafka has done similar work to
yeah.
this. But you mention in the book a writer I don't know about, somebody named Murakami.
Right.
What's that?
Haruki Murakami is sort of I guess at the time, is sort of an avant-garde writer and such, and recently has gotten quite a bit of acclaim and such. I think his most recent one, I think he's got a series of shorts out right now, but I think his most recent one that got a lot of acclaim was Kafka on the Shore. And he kind of blends a certain mystery. He'll have like Johnny Walker is one of the characters, and fish falling out of the sky during what would be relatively a mundane story. And it's these strange juxtapositions of normal everyday life and then this strange mysterious things happening.
Is this like a surrealist painting or something?
Where, yeah, kind where, of.
You know, like a Magritte or a you know, something like that.
Yeah, you look at it and it kind of makes sense, but yet it doesn't. It's like, wait a minute, I sort of see something, but is that what the artist put in there or didn't? And it lends itself to a lot of ambiguity, I guess.
I'll tell you what, one of the things that reminded me of more, even than Kafka, there was a series of Russian novels in the late 19th and early 20th century,
mm-hmm.
The Last Gasp of the Tsar, just before the Russian Revolution, where there was a bureaucracy in Russia, and they were the bureaucrats were working under the worst kind of conditions in a basically a monarchy without any care for the people. So they were crushed between the government and the people demanding things from them. Mm-hmm. And there was a series of Russian novels about people like this, one called The Petty Demon, which involves doppelgangers and watching your life fall apart, starts to crumble at the edges, and mm-hmm. you wonder where it's going to stop.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read any of those things. Or
the only one I think was, I don't know if it was Dostoevsky or I think it was Dostoevsky.
Notes from the Underground?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, that one.
Yeah, that's, mm-hmm. that's a good one. That's
yeah, and
a
that
good
was
example.
Exactly, you know, one of the things I was kind of thinking of is what if you did have somebody that looked exactly like you and stuff like that, but went out and did this infamous stuff, and you were the one that was blamed for it. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about George Olson. George Olson leads a life of quiet futility, maybe right. not so quiet sometimes,
yeah.
but he has a crummy job. He works for a publisher. There's a crummy job for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. His wife is a wonderful woman named Francesca. She's Spanish. They have, mm-hmm. He has a beautiful little daughter named Mirabella. But right at the beginning of the book where he gets lost in a Costco parking lot,
yeah,
you know there's not all's right with this guy. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I guess that was sort of like setting up the fact that he could have a certain like a wandering mind or spirit and such that he gets lost someplace else than where he should be. And I guess it seems like Costco's such an interesting place, you know, people going there and herding in and herding out and gathering such. And he, at the time, you don't really know where he's going, and he's just kind of by the wayside and like floating on their energy and such. Kind of a precursor, I suppose, to the rest of the story.
I've got a great Costco story for him. I know I'm taking your time, but
no.
I'm going to tell it anyway.
Yeah.
Somebody used to work here, worked with Russian immigrants. She mm-hmm. spoke Russian fluently. And when people came here, they were used to the conditions in Russia, which is like no food, waiting online for everything.
Right.
And she needed some help going to Costco because she was buying stuff for the facility, and she brought a recent immigrant Russian woman. When the woman walked into Costco, she fell on her knees and started weeping.
Yeah.
She had never
seen
so much
light.
Stuff
yeah.
in her entire life. So
absolutely.
Costco can do weird things
yeah.
to people.
Yeah.
It does weird things to us, and we see this mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
This book is graphically interesting. How much input
yeah.
did you have? I'll explain. Well, you explain what goes on in the book, different typefaces, things like that. How much input did you have into that?
The only input I really had was with one of the characters, X, is George's...
Nameless mistress.
Right. And I asked that, you know, that we would only see her first letter, X, and, you know, leave some mystery there. As since it's told in the first person, you know, was he wanted to keep a certain anonymity around that character. But in regards to the typeface, the setup and everything like that, it was all Ulligan Press and the stuff and their creativity, and they did it. And I think what's interesting is when you look at it is the squares on the side are binary code, which mm-hmm. correspond to the numbers. Theoretically, the spacings in the page add up to 4.2 centimeters. Theoretically, there's 24 lines per page, I think, which if you invert, it's 42. So it's all that more subversive code, which sort of parallels George's paranoia of seeing 42 everywhere in his life.
Whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad, I guess.
Yeah.
what's interesting is that there are... first of all, the layouts of the page are very nice, but the mistress's name, instead of being an X, is blocked out as if somebody's gone over it with a magic marker mm-hmm. and taken out her name. I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There are yellow sticky notes, or they're not yellow, but they're right. the equivalent of yellow sticky notes all over the book because George is always leaving himself.
Yeah, he's got a wandering
messages.
Mind, yeah.
Yes. There are places where the type fades out and where it's gone over itself. Truthfully, the first time you saw the galleys on this thing, you just say, this is distracting for my story.
Initially, I suppose I had that, but then when they started, you know, explaining certain parts of it and stuff, I thought it worked. And I think, you know, is in regards to publishing and where it's sort of headed, I think we need to start experimenting with new ways to present the written word. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully, you know, is this somehow helps and leaves the avenue open for other things. I mean, you know, accompanying CDs, anything like that, or... I mean, I suppose you could write a story and then have a Facebook, you know, page for it, which they're doing, but somehow it incorporates that and helps with a storyline or something like that. So
yeah, Facebook is becoming the lingua franca of the
yeah,
new world.
Yeah.
Have you got any feedback? Have you gotten any reviews or anything like this from people who said yay or nay on the graphical?
It's really gone both ways. It's really interesting. Some of the traditionalists, you know, they like just words on the page and such, and they just want the story and the words. Where other people find it very fascinating once they learn about, you know, some people with a more mathematical background and computers such are aware of the binary code and they love it. And so it's one of those things, and it seems like it's sort of what the story lends itself to. It's sort of an ambiguous story, and you know, when you get done with it, it's like, well, did this happen? Didn't it? Maybe it was insane. Maybe it wasn't. You know.
Yeah. So. Well, my reservations aside for the idea, it actually works in this book because we are talking about the deterioration of a human mind.
Right.
Yeah. And the crazier the book is, the more it seems to feed back onto it.
I think so.
Okay. So one day George discovers that Francesca and Mirabella are gone. They are no longer there. He's left with Zeus, his dog, and Tyler, his cat. Mm-hmm. There is a note. If I tread too heavily on the plot, you have to tell me, okay?
No, I know the plot, so it'd be the listeners.
The question is, how much of it do you want me to give away? That's the problem.
Well, at this juncture, you will put the little disclaimer. Any listeners out there that plan on reading the book and don't want to hear the plot, please sign off now and get back to us at a later date.
I hope I'm not giving away any spoilers here, but she does leave a note, and where she talks about disappearing like smoke, and you know, so
that's
a quote from Murakami. And he writes some little note, says, where does the first use of that phrase, like smoke, come from? Mm-hmm. This is the kind of stuff, his life has just gone into the toilet, and he's curious. Oh, he's
that.
An editor, though.
Yeah,
right?
I wonder what that reference is,
exactly,
and somehow the significance. And
more things begin to happen. His life in the office gets very strange all of a sudden. His car winds up missing, and in his parking spot is a blue Vega.
Mm-hmm.
He decides he's going to use his wife's red Eurostar van, and that disappears. And then Zeus disappears.
Yes, unfortunately.
Oh, Tyler disappears first,
yes.
The cat.
Yeah, it's a slow progression.
And then eventually the dog disappears, and he's increasingly bereft. Mm-hmm. And since he has a problem with booze anyway, wine. I'm telling the whole story. I want you to tell us. Tell us about the blue Vega, and tell us about his tendency to overanalyze everything that everybody says to him after a while.
Well, I guess after a while it's like, you know, once he's latched on to 42 is sort of the meaning of how he's going to find his family and reunite with them, is he starts kind of overanalyzing everything. What somebody says has significance. What somebody's wearing has significance. The blue Vega has significance. Suddenly, the world isn't just a facade. It's carrying a certain message or hidden meaning behind it. And so everything everybody says is like, oh, wait, they're not just saying, it's the subtext. You know, it's like, okay, this is what they said, but what do they really mean? And in regards to the blue Vega, I suppose it's just, I thought it was funny. You know, a blue Vega, I don't know, one of those old kind of things and that kind of,
Because his car is gone.
Right.
He has to take a cab.
Mm-hmm.
He leaves his briefcase in a cab, and because of that, we meet Steve.
Oh, Steve, yes.
Yeah. Now, before you tell us about Steve, I want to remind our listeners I'm speaking with M. Thomas Cooper, Michael Cooper. Title of his novel is 42, the number 42, and it's published by Ooligan Press. What goes on with Steve?
He goes down and talks to Steve about, you know, his briefcase being lost in a taxi and such, and Steve isn't the most helpful of individuals, and they get into a little spat, and George ends up hitting him and hurting his hand, and Steve ends up becoming one of the classic kind of stalker guy that just keeps calling and calling, and it's just sort of more of a breakdown of George's whole life. Is like one thing leads to another, and it's just this crumbling mass of stuff that, you know, and with Zeus disappearing and Tyler disappearing, his whole world is just coming apart. So I guess at the time I was thinking more of along the lines of the Job myth, you know, is God and the devil are arguing and they take everything away from him. And that's sort of what I was going with George, is like, what would happen if George was all alone? Like, he'd have none of the things he relied on, which was Mirabella and Francesca's love and all this other such. And so sort of the beginning of the end.
I always wondered about Job. It's the first example of the devil made me do it.
Mm-hmm. And it's exactly. Yeah. they were conspiring.
Exactly, yeah. I wondered about that. He's lost his entire George has lost eventually his entire support structure. His wife is gone. His child is gone. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have many friends to speak of. No. He has a mistress who just continues to make demands on him. He meets a young woman in a park walking a dog named June, and all she does is put more aggravation mm-hmm. and mystery into his life.
Yes.
He's really falling apart. And to make matters worse, Francesco is a very popular person, and she has friends,
They
keep calling.
Yeah.
Tell us about what happens when, I guess it's Leslie and her husband Nate, more or less run into George. Tell us about that little scene.
Yeah, they're walking down the South Park blocks. I don't know if we've mentioned that. It takes place
in Portland.
Takes place in Portland. So George has spent the night with X, and they wake up together, and they're walking Zeus down the South Park blocks towards Portland State, and they run into Leslie and Nate, friends, and it's once again George's paranoia takes over, like they're following him or somebody else, a greater power, or just the strange coincidence that have been happening are conspiring against him again. And I think that's sort of at that juncture he's really beginning to lose it, in the sense that he doesn't know if there is some strange force conspiring against him or if it's just all in his mind. And I think that's when it really begins. And if there's a movie that's mentioned in the book, Abre los Ojos, a Spanish movie, and that's sort of the thing is the main character.
Before Your Eyes, is that what that means?
Yeah, I think they
open your eyes.
Open Your Eyes, yeah. And they made a Vanilla Sky, I think that was a bad remake.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible, yeah.
But the main character is actually dead or in a state of psychosis or whatnot, and then you find out that later on that he's actually dead and the computer program is going over and over. And that's sort of what George starts wondering is like, am I in some matrix or whatnot? So,
when things start to go bad for George, they go really bad.
Yes.
Okay. Because Francesca's friends are calling up and they're leaving increasingly hysterical messages, including threats to call the police and things like mm-hmm. that. Because he's not he's not calling them back, and certainly Francesca's not calling them back.
Mm-hmm.
I found it perfectly within. I mean, I'm thinking about this as a kind of a precursor to paranoid schizophrenia, mm-hmm. what he's going through, and it seems perfectly plausible for him not to return these calls. All he would have to do is return the calls and say, "Francesca left me. I don't know what to do. If you're my friend too, let's talk." That blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. This would be rational.
Right.
But he's not rational.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I think also he has a certain guilt. He hasn't been the best of fathers and such, and their leaving him is already, is just reinforcing the fact that he's been inadequate. And I think that's one of the other things, like, to face what everybody else knows about you is always a difficult thing. And I think that's sort of also one of the reasons he doesn't let people know. It's like, well, as long as I don't tell them, I can kind of live the lie of being an adequate father, which everybody hopefully thinks he is. But once he confronts that, it's like, oops. I am a bad father. I am a bad husband, et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah. So whatever he does is just
he turns
bad,
right?
Yeah. He makes some attempt to find out what's going on, and he calls his wife's therapist, Mrs. Sandquist.
Mm-hmm.
Describe his relationship with Mrs. Sandquist and what goes on with that.
Well, I think initially he was hoping that she would, disclose why Francesco is seeing him or seeing her, is maybe that would like lead to some way he could find Francesca. But invariably, Mrs. Sandquist, being British, had certain rules and regulations about being a therapist.
Well, there's professional ethics.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
She actually followed them where George would like, why don't you tell me? And so invariably, he kind of not necessarily stalks her, but goes and visits her more than is necessary. And eventually he breaks down and kind of confesses to her what's going on. And that's when he learns about something called a psychogenic fugue state. And it's basically sort of, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of thing. But, it's due to, they're actually not sure what causes it, but basically one moment you're in your normal everyday state and mind, you're being Mr. Ed Goldberg, and next thing you know, for whatever reason, certain stressors and stuff cause you to go into this altered state, and next thing you're your doctor. Or
I would choose Brad Pitt, frankly, if I had to make a choice.
Yeah, well, you could stub, Seacrest and get away with it.
His wife's Eurostar van. I'm mm-hmm. not going to go too deep into this. I'll let you talk about mm-hmm. as much about it as you want. Eventually, it's discovered, and Like Us We Go. Right. Tell us about that.
Well, it's I suppose it's like, you know, we were talking about his Jobian sense is, okay, how many of these artifices of his life can we take away from him? And that's basically what, you know, is like theoretically plot like, you know, if you're, you know, you keep piling on, you know, the main character. And I guess I just want to take everything away. And the red Eurovan ends up in the lake with a dead body in it, and invariably it happens to be the son of his boss, and like one thing after another, and George, you know, is like, what's going on? I'm not doing anything. Literally, he's not doing anything. He's not called the police. He hasn't, you know, confessed anything. He's just standing there still, and all this stuff is swirling around him. And I guess in that sense, it's just, I think that's to a certain extent what a lot of us happens to us, is that, you know, you're living your life in seemingly one way, but there's all this stuff happening around you, conspiring to a certain extent. And you wake up the next day and suddenly you've been, you know, maybe if you were with Circuit City like today, they just were closing down how many stores and stuff like that. So I guess that's George, is suddenly his life is closing and whatnot.
As I read this book, I wondered to myself, did you sit there with a pad and a pen and try to think up ways that you could torture this poor man?
No, I think they just kind of came naturally as the story evolved.
That scares me even more.
Yeah. When you start looking around, it's like, okay, what else can you destroy? You know, or not necessarily destroy in a sadistic way, but, you know, take away from him and see where, you know, what are you if you don't have anything, I suppose, is the real question. And what he realizes, I suppose, is that he's really nothing without his family, without the support of his family and such, which I think most of us would probably agree with to a certain extent, that without others, you know, life is somewhat meaningless. And I think he never really thought about it. He hasn't really thought about a lot of what it meant to be alive and such. And I think this is, you know, the loss of a lot, you know, his family, cars, job, et cetera, made him realize and look more deeply into his life and what it was, what it means to be alive.
Well, there's that old folk saying that you don't miss the water till the well runs dry. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially if you've got plants to water in.
So now that you're a published novelist, what are you doing next? Are you in the midst of another book? Have you finished another book? What's going on?
I've finished the sequel.
There's a sequel?
Well, I guess it's not rightly called a sequel per se. It's more of a follow-up novel or something like that.
Okay.
It's about the author of 42, not me, but the theoretical author of 42. And what's the tagline? Something like a young novelist suspected by the FBI, NSA of weaving a subversive code into a manuscript finds himself committed to a psychiatric hospital.
I hope that's not the subtitle.
No. Yeah. Colon. Yeah.
How far along are you?
I'm actually finished with the first draft.
Uh-huh.
So right now that's sitting. I've started another novel.
Really?
I don't do much else. Right and whatnot.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, no, yeah.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. And then I just had a small collection of short plays published by Samuel French. So I've got sort of my toe in the playwriting thing, too.
Excellent. Any of them produced?
Yeah, actually, one of the plays, Tongue Tied, was done at the Humana Festival in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
Humana Festival of New American Plays. And that got a little bit of attention. And that's how Samuel French ended up finding about it. And then it did a 5-week run down in Miami. So I've got another short play up for the...
Were you there for opening night on both instances?
I was for Kentucky. Louisville, they flew me back. And that's a... It's a big, big thing as far as playwriting and such is concerned.
I felt really
overjoyed that they accepted it. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Got another one up for Heidemann Award this year, and we'll see what happens with that. But things are happening slowly.
This is a silly question, but I'll ask it anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Was there any blowback from this? I mean, you're sitting there delving into a deteriorating mind.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever wake up, but stand up from a day's work and get creeped out, say, ew, this is,
Well, what was interesting is I like George, after I was done with it, kind of became hypervigilant about the number 42. And is the beautiful thing about 42 is it's like with 23 is a prime number, where 42 obviously isn't. There's so many permutations, 42, four
Six times
two.
Seven,
absolutely.
Right.
So you start seeing it all over. And I think one of the interesting things was I heard somewhere like the hypothetical density of the universe right now is 10 to the 42nd power. Then there was just some other ways that you can manipulate it, like with the Beijing Olympics. Mm-hmm. It took place on 808 at 8 p.m. And you know, the eights and stuff like that, 4 times 2 is 8. And that would be the only blowback with me. I've been trying to wean myself of the 42-isms and such. So as far as that, yeah, it's amazing. I suppose if I knew that 42 is going to become such a problem with me, I may have titled it something else. Or
well, I don't know. I'm no expert, but you don't look crazy to me yet.
So. Yes, yet. I think that's the underlying. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
You know, yet. I mean,
hopefully
you
got time.
That is all we can say. It's been fun talking to
absolutely.
You. I've been talking with
M.
Thomas Cooper, the author of 42, a novel, and published by Ooligan Press. Come back with your books once they're out on the street.
Absolutely. Love to.
Have you again.
Yeah, likewise.